That's all I would like to think about today, if possible. Just pizza. Is anything else going on? No.
Nah. Hey, everybody. It's Kyle Rusdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us on this podcast is as smart as all of us, is what you like to say.
So true. Every single day. I'm Molly Wood. It is Tuesday. That means we are settled in a comfy chair with a cup of coffee for a weekly deep dive into a single topic.
I don't have coffee. I didn't bring coffee.
Oh, what?
I totally should have got some coffee. That's my bad.
You probably had your coffee like 7 hours ago already. Guys, it's already bedtime for him.
I kind of did, yeah. anyway, so today being Tuesday, deep dive. We're talking minimum wage today because it is very much in the news. And we'll do a little setup here and then we'll get to the person who actually knows what's going on. And the setup starts like this. The minimum wage federally in this economy right now is $7.25 an hour, has not budged in more than a decade.
More than a decade. And full disclosure, I honestly had not 100% realized that until I kept hearing it on these Amazon ads for a podcast because they were bragging about their $15 an hour minimum wage. And I was like, this thing hasn't gone up since 2009. Now there is a proposal, of course, to raise it to $15 an hour by 2025. I'm sure you're hearing a lot about this. Democrats are actually trying to include that in the COVID-19 relief package. It has run into a couple of snags.
And here's one that I'm going to say caught everybody by surprise yesterday, because the Congressional Budget Office came out on Monday, today being Tuesday, with an analysis that was really pretty interesting about the federal minimum wage. And among the many other things they said was that raising it to $15 an hour could result in 1.4 million jobs lost in this economy, but it would also lift 900,000 people in this economy out of poverty and raise wages for 17 million more. So there's a whole lot of back and forth, both sides. How do we feel about this that deserves to be taken apart here?
Yeah, and it is, in fact, very timely that came out just yesterday, as we were poised to have this conversation with Aaron Dubay, a professor of labor economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I mean, I feel like we should start with that report, right? What was your response to those numbers, especially the job loss numbers?
Right. So it's sometimes hard to make sense of big top line numbers. 1.4 million certainly sounds like a large number. But then you look at the number of people who are actually going to get a raise. And it turns out that according to the CBO's projection, the overall impact of the policies to raise wages quite a bit more than reduce jobs. And as a result, leading to about close to a million people going above poverty level. Now, that's, I think, the big picture. Now, then we can kind of take a deep dive into, well, does it make sense? Do their projections make sense? My overall takeaway is that I think their estimates are a bit too pessimistic, including compared to the similar analysis they did a few years back. They were a little less pessimistic. And I don't think the research should make us more pessimistic today than we were a few years ago, because I think the high quality research on this topic actually tends to suggest pretty small employment effects to date.
Can I ask kind of a foundational question here? And the answer is going to seem silly, right? Because it's obviously politics, you idiot. But why is this so hard to get consensus on?
That's a great question. And, you know, I am not entirely sure why, because it's actually really popular to raise the minimum wage in the United States. It's popular across the partisan divide, which is pretty hard to do for, you know, when it comes to policies these days. But at the same time, it just becomes very embroiled in politics at the national level or even in state legislatures. But then if you put it actually as a ballot initiative, it pretty much always passes, including in sort of red states, blue states, purple states.
With whom is it not popular?
So it's not popular among, for example, restaurant owners. And some low-wage businesses. Interestingly, it's actually used to be more strongly opposed by larger retailers, for example, like Walmart or restaurant chains like McDonald's. But interestingly, now major retailers are actually for a major increase in the national minimum wage, and McDonald's is neutral. So that's been different than before.
Why do we need a federal minimum wage? Because for all that we like to talk about the American labor market, it's not like there is one actual labor market in this country, right? It's different in Mississippi, it's different in North Dakota, and it's different in Manhattan. And it's one thing for somebody in an upscale shop or an upscale company in Manhattan where living expenses are high to have to pay their workers $15 an hour. And it's another thing for somebody running an insurance company in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Yeah. So as a practical matter, the federal minimum wage serves mainly as a floor across the nation. So we have like about 30 states that have higher minimums than the 725 federal standard. Mm-hmm. But these 20 or so states, it's very hard to actually raise minimum wages in the state legislatures. These are states, for example, Alabama or Mississippi, Texas. It's not because residents of those states don't want to increase the minimum wage, but it does not happen at the state legislature level unless it's put in the form of a ballot initiative. But that's costly. And so as a practical matter, we've gone for almost a dozen years, right, without raising the minimum wage in these states. So the way I would think about it is the federal minimum wage will be sort of a baseline standard. And above that, you will likely have higher wage blue states that will, again, increase the minimum somewhat above that. That's, I think, a sensible way of doing things. It's not the only way of doing things. It's possible to have tiered minimum wages, but in general, it's in the United States mostly folks have wanted to use a single federal standard and then allow states to go above that.
Is, you know, the longstanding argument, of course, against this is that it leads to job losses. And the CBO report does seem to treat that as a given. And I wonder what your thoughts are. Is it a given? Like, has research consistently shown that, you know, instituting a minimum wage, raising a minimum wage, inevitably leads to job losses? The end?
So I don't think that's true. So 2019, I was asked by the UK Treasury to look exactly at this question, and I produced a report for the UK Treasury that summarized the international evidence from the US, UK, Germany, and other high-income countries. And you know, what I found is that overall, right, the most up-to-date research points to fairly muted effect of minimum wages on employment while really sharply increasing the earnings of low-paid workers. And this includes some of the more recent ambitious policies, both in the U.S. as well as, for example, in the U.K., which has actually raised the minimum wage quite a bit. So, you know, and I used a similar methodology as the CBO, but just used more studies and also looked at the quality of the studies. So if you look at sort of the most comprehensive estimates, looking at the overall impact of low-wage jobs in the U.S., for example, published in top leading economics journals, those tend to actually suggest relatively mild impacts of the policy. Mm. So for that reason, I think that, and other economists will agree that I think the CBO estimates are more pessimistic than what the current research frontier actually suggests. This is not to say there's no disagreement about that, right? Economists definitely disagree on this topic. However, I think the weight of the evidence is pretty clearly moved towards finding relatively small effects. That's not to say that there won't be any effect. Right. And it is also important to acknowledge that $15 would go above where we have been. So there are some unknowns. So I think that's something we should keep in mind as well.
So I should have done the math before I asked this question, but $15 an hour doesn't actually get you very far. Right. It doesn't get you, I think, above median wage in this country. Right. So why not like $20 an hour? Why not like 25 and really make it worthwhile?
Right. So $15 by 2025 is probably going to get to about two-thirds of the median wage in the country. Just for example, the Conservative Party in the UK has proposed going up to about 2/3 of the median wage, and that's their on their way towards that target. And so far, interestingly, in UK, this is not a controversial topic. Both major parties on the left and right agree to have a substantial minimum wage. There's a general consensus amongst primary stakeholders in the society. It's a very, very different scenario. But I use the 2/3 as an example because that's about where we would be. Now, why not higher? I mean, to be honest, I think we haven't really hit the place where we see very serious job losses. That's my reading of the evidence. But at some point, that would happen. So I think the question is, what is a responsible way of pushing the wage further than we have before? Yeah. And that's important because in this country, we have had such low federal minimum wages that in some ways, the fact that we would go outside of past experience is almost a given because past experience has been to really keep the minimum wage pretty low.
Mm-hmm. And then what about the economic halo effect, right? Again, going back to those CBO numbers or the idea of job loss, you know, we have been conditioned to believe that spreading wealth around raises all boats, right? That there will be a trickle-down effect to workers who make more money, spending that money, stimulating the economy, creating opportunities for more jobs. Is there empirical evidence for that?
So I think there's definitely empirical evidence that people spend more, especially at the bottom, including, you know, borrowing money to buy cars or paying down other types of debt and also spending more. That can have some positive impact in terms of stimulating the economy, but let's be clear, that's going to be a pretty small part of the story because low wage earnings are just not a very large part of the overall GDP. Almost by definition, they're the lowest wage workers. So it doesn't add a lot to the overall stimulus. Now, that may not be true everywhere. Some local communities, you could see greater spending spurring that type of stimulus. But overall, my sense is what a higher minimum wage would do is would be partly captured by higher prices paid for by middle and higher income families to help raise earnings at the bottom. That's probably the most likely way the policy would actually get implemented.
Do you think this is a moment for the minimum wage coming out of this pandemic with all the economic damage it has brought? Do you suppose there's opportunity here?
So the pandemic has certainly highlighted how difficult life has been for low-wage workers. You know, we have this K-shaped recovery where the bottom end of the labor market is experiencing very, very different dynamics than those at the middle and top. And also has highlighted, for example, the risks service workers are taking in supermarkets and other places to their own health. So I think that is something that highlights the importance of actually having a wage that is sufficient for those at the bottom. I think it's hard to know exactly how the minimum wage would play out during this period, but I think no one is suggesting that we raise the minimum wage to $15 this year or even next year. So I sort of take the longer view here that think about where we want to be 4 or 5 years from now. That should really guide our policymaking today as opposed to just this minute.
You know, it's hard to escape. I mean, I'm listening to you describe this kind of like unproven negative effect, controversy that it doesn't trickle down to people. I mean, it's hard to avoid the chilling conclusion that we haven't raised the minimum wage in this country because we just don't care. That it won't have if it won't have a meaningful effect on GDP, for example, or consumption, that we, as a country and a matter of policy, have not been able to be bothered with the working poor.
And I think it's certainly true that if you look at national politics, it doesn't seem to look like it cares about the working poor. I think that has certainly been true. And that's true with a broad array of policies. I'm hopeful that that's changing. And I'm hopeful that we are seeing better policies coming out that actually can help those at the bottom. And I take the minimum wage as one part of that.
What super quick, just on the way out here, what are the other parts? Right? Because you can't just raise minimum wage in isolation.
Absolutely. I think reforming our unemployment insurance system can go a long way to help those at the bottom. Reforming the earned income tax credit to make it more generous can also play a really important role. The proposed child tax credit is great as well. So I think, you know, I see the minimum wage as one of the arrows in our quiver we have, along with generous support for those who don't have a job, as well as those who are at the bottom of the distribution, and to reduce child poverty. All of these things we can do. And I think the minimum wage plays one role in that broad array of policies.
Yeah, because fundamentally, right? I mean, you mentioned child poverty and the rest of it. This is a discussion about inequality in this economy and how much longer we're going to tolerate it.
Absolutely. And it's about equitable growth. Are we going to grow together or apart?
Right. Aaron Dubé, he's a professor of labor economics at UMass Amherst. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Not the last of this debate, to be sure.
Not at all, yeah. Sure. I don't even think that when we started planning this show, we knew exactly how timely it was going to turn out to be.
Props to us.
But it's kind of great how it works out like that. Yeah, it's just, it is absolutely fascinating. And one of those things where when you really start to think about it, you're like, what?
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Yes. Anyway, all right. Good talk.
We're going to take a break. comments on today's show come to us best in a voice memo. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Coming right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
And we're back with
magic.
Our little news fix, a little magic. Update on what's happening.
Magic.
What you got?
Mine's a quickie. Out of the news today, there's been this World Health Organization team over in Wuhan, China, looking for the root cause of this thing that has affected the entire planet for a year. And they came out today with their preliminary report that said, yeah, we don't know. We don't know. Probably was not a lab leak, but otherwise couldn't really tell you where it came from. So, Yeah. Unable to conclude whether the virus had passed directly from animal to human or through an intermediary host. Very unlikely to have spread as a result of a lab accident, which is actually nice and promising and also takes care of a bunch of conspiracy theories that are out there.
I mean, one hopes, yes.
Yeah. Well, as hard as conspiracy theories are to kill. But it's important that we keep track of how we got to where we are. And this is one little step of that.
Yep, absolutely. I have gone in a wildly different direction today to a totally nerdy topic that I'm fascinated by, which is that we just don't make a lot of semiconductors in America anymore. And it is a problem.
Yeah.
There was a super interesting story about Intel and how we should all be worried about the fact that Intel, which of course makes computer chips for all kinds of things, including, and this is what's so fascinating, cars. Mm-hmm. Like, there is a massive production shortage for semiconductors to put in cars. Yeah. And it is actually impacting the ability of major automakers to make enough cars to meet demand, which is just fascinating.
GM is closing factories.
Yeah.
Right? Temporary
shutdowns. And it's literally because of chips. Yeah. Like, because we just don't. And we don't really manufacture chips here. We have like Qualcomm, and which makes mainly wireless chips, and then Intel, which makes semiconductors. And that's kind of it. And so we have this like extreme reliance. I mean, it's just like this really interesting story about onshoring and technology development, and then a thing that China has put like a ton of very specific mm-hmm. energy into, which is figuring out how to make its own chips. And then Apple, meanwhile, is like manufacturing its own chips, but like only for iPhones, which lovely, but like maybe open that up and make some for cars. I don't know. I just am
Apple's going to make chips for its own cars. Thank you very much. Right? Uh-huh. I mean, that's where that one's going.
Yeah, I'll drink like a 6-pack of hazy IPA when Apple actually makes a car. Not happening.
Well, that's Molly putting my money where her mouth is on that one.
It's going to be a good show. It does happen. But I don't think it's going to.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I'm like weirdly obsessed with the auto chip shortage and all of its like strange globalization and intended consequences aspects.
Do you remember the days you could pop the hood and you could like fix your car? You know?
Man, I had a 68 Mustang in high school, and you could stand inside the hood of that thing. Yeah. Yeah. It was basically just like, you know, straight six, engine block, that's it. And then all this space, then some connectors, some hoses and junk. Yeah. Good. Those were the good old days, children.
Oh, God. How do we get so old?
You can fix your own car.
That's a whole different show. Whole different show. All right, mailbag. Come on, before we actually tell you how old we are.
Let's do it. Yep.
Hello, Molly and Kyle. Hello.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Okay, then.
That car was vintage when I had it, to be clear. It was not, like, I wasn't.
I bought it new in 1968.
I'm not a vampire.
Oh, man.
Okay, sorry. On to the
mail. All right, mailbag. We heard from Haley down in Florida last year. She's a graduate student. She sent us a voice memo about university teaching during this coronavirus economy. And here is an update.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Kai and Molly. You wanted an update on university teaching, and here it is.
Okay.
In-person classes are infinitely better than Zoom, but it's also terrifying. Even with reduced class sizes in many situations, social distancing isn't really possible. I and lots of my coworkers have had students test positive before even the first day of class. It's hard to feel like the university admin care about COVID when my health and safety depends on around 60 other people that I don't know. Mm-hmm. It also seriously impacts my own risk assessment because this is just from teaching, not from anybody else that I know. I'm grateful I get to talk to people, but frankly, the vaccine can't come soon enough.
Yeah.
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 Let's get those teachers and university professors that vaccine, shall we? So that we can get everybody back in the classroom.
I know, because even though I really understand the dilemma of our new CDC director who's saying, you know, there are enough precautions we can take that teachers don't necessarily have to be vaccinated. I also understand why that was such a like hubbub and freak out, because teachers are rightfully terrified.
Yeah.
Because we have so many systems that aren't taking care of them.
Right.
And it's like, you know what? Just better safe than sorry.
Well, it's like all the studies showing that the economic contraction early in this pandemic was not caused by government shutdown. It was caused by consumers saying, I am not doing that. And that's part of what's going on here, right? The teachers are like, you got to be kidding me. And you get that.
Yeah.
You totally get it.
You really, really, really do. Because it's not like we have demonstrated a lot of care for teachers in this society for the last 40 to 50 years. Yeah. So, fair point, teachers. Last week, we heard from a listener who was pleased with how Corpus Christi is distributing vaccines. Here's another listener in another location with a slightly different experience.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I'm Sarah from Ohio. I have a father in his mid-70s who is a widower. And I will not go into the amount of frustration that I dealt with trying to get him an appointment for the vaccine. He did get it this week, but it was just so frustrating. Now, my father and I were very lucky because we have excellent health insurance. We have excellent Wi-Fi connectivity. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person who I had enough technical expertise, was able to keep checking to make this appointment for him to get a shot. Think of all the people who do not have what we have. And it just makes me so angry. This is what happens when we do not have a concerted federal response to such a catastrophic event. By the end of the month, we're going to have at least 500,000 of our fellow Americans who will have died, plus countless others who have been adversely affected by this pandemic. It just makes me want to scream.
You are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
You are not alone. Mm-hmm. I know that we all, it's going to take a lot of years to untangle everything that happened in the last 4 years, and particularly the last year. But when you hear statements out of the Biden administration, such as the response to the pandemic from the federal perspective is even more dire than we thought, like, I can't imagine how we can not have some version of a 9/11 commission to figure out what this government did to us.
So like, look, I was just thinking about that. And while I agree with the sentiment, I don't think it's realistic. And here's why. 9/11 was a specific discrete incident. January 6th mm-hmm. at the Capitol was a specific discrete incident. Yes, with some antecedents. This has been a rolling story, ever changing, with Hydra-like tentacles that go everywhere for a year. And I don't know that we're going to be able to put it into a single commission. I think this one truly will depend on the historians and the PhD theses over the next 25 years to unpack what happened. I don't know that we're going to have a satisfactory answer anytime soon. True, that's comprehensive, right?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. I mean, we do have laws that govern the retention of federal records.
Yes, we do.
Evidence gathering could be, and I mean,
we also have laws against insurrection in the Capitol, but you know, just
I know, just saying. I just it's like it's real. We all want to scream, and I don't want it to be like one of those things where I mean, I just feel like this period in American history there's a danger of it becoming basically our 2008, 2009, right, where this huge thing happened, where there was definitely malfeasance or at a minimum amoral apathy toward the future of the rest of the world. It broke the global economy and there were essentially no consequences for it. And I think that we are living the reaction to that right now. Like it sows the seeds of that kind of populism. And so in terms of restoring trust in institutions, as we, you know, try to reflect on a year in which the government literally, apparently on purpose, did not take care of us as a populace, I think that the seeds that plants are really dangerous for our country.
Yeah,
at a time when a lot of dangerous seeds are already blooming all
right,
over.
Right. But look, we had
I'm not arguing with you exactly.
I get it. We had a Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and yet still we got the Tea Party out of that. We got Occupy Wall Street. We got the 2016 election, right? I mean, we did the introspection. I mean, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report was a snoozer.
Because all we had was like a report. Yeah, yeah. We just had like a book report, not accountability.
Yep.
Yeah.
Amanda in Ohio.
Anyway.
Amanda. Freelance marketing consultant, graphic designer. Here is what she says.
And so I was very fortunate to be able to get some of the extra unemployment when they put the PUA program into effect last year. But then that ended in August, and, you know, I was out that $600 a week, and I was left with about $170 a week from the state. Luckily, I was building back my client base for my consulting, so I was at least making enough money to, you know, pay rent and food and all that kind of stuff. January of this year was the first month that I actually felt like I billed enough to really have almost a living wage and, you know, have a little squirreled away for the next month. And then this morning I go into my bank account and there is $8,000 sitting there of backdated unemployment since August. And the irony is totally not lost on me that the month when I don't need it is when I finally get the money I've needed for the last 6 months. And if that's my situation, it just makes me think about all these other people who weren't fortunate enough to find a way to eke out some sort of existence in the past year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's
without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
I mean, the consequences of this are going to, you know, it's like a weird, we keep talking about how strange it is to exist in a time of good intent, right? A time when an administration full of professionals, regardless of politics, with the intent to help people, is plugging away and that wants to feel good. And yet the consequences of all of this are still around us and it's still raging every day. And it's confusing. It is a confusing time.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who didn't find that way.
Yep. Yep.
Yep. All right. Now, because we are spiraling toward the dark place, we're going to pull on out, leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? So, and it's a fun one.
It is a super fun one. So we had on Marketplace a couple of weeks ago a song about Janet Yellen by the rapper Dessa, talking about the first female secretary of the Treasury. And anyway, we asked her, listen to the track. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Anyway, we asked Dessa the Make Me Smart question.
For a long time in my career, I thought I was a really lousy collaborator. And I was, because, you know, I would sit around a table with a bunch of other lyricists and they were having so much fun. And I was kind of a drag. I was stressed out by the process. I didn't write as fast as everybody else. And as I've gotten older, I realized that I do have sort of an unattractive sense of territorialism when it comes to words. But I'm a really good collaborator when I'm partnering with people who have really different skill sets. So in the past, you know, 10 and 15 years, I've collaborated with the Minnesota Orchestra, and I've collaborated with a dentist to make like a retainer that would light up inside my mouth while I sang. And so for me, I've reframed the idea of what it means to work with people. It's less like gathering like minds and similar talents with a shared vision. And instead, it's a gathering of people with different interests and really varied skill sets to see what kind of new thing we can build together that it might have occurred to none of us to build alone. Emo,
that's cool.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. That's
but
cool.
I dig it.
That's cool. That's cool.
That's so great. Yeah. It was a version of None of Us is as Smart
that's
as
exactly
All of Us.
Right. That's exactly right. Super cool.
Yes. And also, listen, Dessa, fellow power strugglers, unite.
Yeah.
I see you. I see you in your unattractive tendencies.
and on that, that's
awesome.
We shall close
that's
the door on the podcast.
Great
that was a great
close.
One. That was a great one. questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, which is, of course, tomorrow. Our email is makemesmart@marketplace.org. If you send us a voice memo, well, let's just say we look favorably upon them as opposed to like emails.
It's true.
That's all I'm saying.
We will read your emails if, you know.
If we have to.
If there is a reason that you cannot record yourself and you're not comfortable, like, we got you. We got you. And send us your answers to the Make Me Smart question. Send those too. What is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? We need more of those. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. It's a thing. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skill. It's a job.
I got to do this. Drew Jostad engineered today. Garrett Lang's going to mix it later, I suppose. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves.
If Garrett feels like it.
You know.
No pressure, buddy.
A little bit of a slacker sometimes. No, I'm kidding.
Not true.
I'm kidding.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.